Welcome to The Blast Zone, the podcast where we dig up the bombs that shook Hollywood and try to find out why they went up in flames. This week, you're going to have to give us a moment, son. Blast Zone needs to think about their entire life before they record. This is Walk Hard. Welcome, welcome, welcome to The Blast Zone.
Welcome to The Blast Zone.
I am John Drake, in-house film critic of my letterboxed account.
And I'm Ian Dukes. I'm a person with thoughts and feelings, and some of them are about movies.
Movies like Walk Hard, which we're talking about today.
That's right.
Exciting. Before we get into that, Ian, how are you doing today?
I woke up this morning out of one of those heartbreakingly sad dreams that you have sometimes that are not actually about anything that happened to you in your real life, but it's still soul-crushing and it ruins your whole day. And so I was an emotional wreck all day just from something that didn't actually happen. But you know what? I'm here now with you guys and ready to go on a beautiful ride.
I've been like text messaging you all day and had no idea that you were going through this existential crisis. Really, you should share these things with me so I can support you because I feel bad that I wasn't there for you. But you're feeling a little better now, I guess?
I'm feeling much better. I'm stoked. We got a funny movie to talk about. We got a funny guest to talk about it with. So what could be better?
Hell yeah. We do have a funny guest joining us today. He is a stand-up comedian, writer for Netflix Fan, family, host of Spitfire Comedy, which is on the last Thursday of every month, the Lincoln Lodge in Chicago, host of the excellent podcast, Here's Where It Went Wrong. It's Andrew Nadeau.
Andrew, welcome.
Oh, I was expecting more follow-up. I go right into it. Normally, this is Andrew, thank you, or Andrew, what have you been up to? It's just my name, and then we're in.
We just shout your name at you and then expect you to pick it up from there.
I was really surprised, too, that you guys do the music live in your intro. I thought this was a post thing. So I heard that and was like, oh, okay, there's no editing. I can't make a single mistake here. If you guys do that live.
This podcast is heavily edited. We just like the way the theme song gets us amped up to record. So
all right, it's a good theme song. All right, that's a bit less pressure than, thank you guys for having me. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, so excited to have you. And how's everything going for you lately?
It's going good. I had one of these dreams last night where, you know, nothing particularly bad happens, but you wake up having an existential crisis. The kind of thing you want to talk about immediately on a podcast. That's how I don't know if either of you have been. We're going to cut out the part where Ian said this if we can and put that afterwards.
That's
and
uncanny.
Make him seem like he's just trying to
this
steal
is like
my
the
thing.
Beginning of the plot of a horror movie where everyone has the same sad dream and then things start going terribly wrong after
It was good. No, my day's been fine. I moved yesterday.
Oh, wow.
I'm getting stuff done. I'm still in my old place because apparently you need Wi-Fi to be willing to live somewhere. Because that happened Saturday, but all my furniture is there. So I'm excited to be here recording.
Well, I expected more echo in your room with no furniture, but it sounds great. So no worries on that end.
No, we've still got it covered pretty well.
Well, you know, one thing we like to do before we get into the movie we talk about is go around and talk about something else we watched unrelated to the podcast that we all thought was interesting. So Andrew, what have you been watching lately that you wanted to talk about?
Well, I mean, obviously I think you should leave since second season has just come out and it was fantastic. I assume you guys are caught up.
Oh, yes.
Because that's what you do the day it comes out. You sit down and watch all of it. I mean, it was amazing. So I watched that. I watched Nobody with Bob Odenkirk, who also had a great spot and I think you should leave. And I just love seeing him in absolutely everything now.
That was maybe my favorite sketch in the new season was the Odenkirk.
It was so good. The classic cars.
No, triples. I have triples.
Oh, God. I mean, I loved the Ghost Tour sketch was both terrific and sad. And oh God, my favorite had to be the driving lessons one, though. That was so fantastic.
Did you guys find this season a little more somber and downbeat than season one? Like a little darker, maybe?
Yeah, I think so. I think they hit that right. I think the first one, they had to be just testing the waters of what are they going to let us do? And then once they found out that people were willing to do it, they can go a bit harder and hit from other angles.
Yeah, absolutely. Ian, what have you got for us this week?
Well, you know, we say, let's talk about something we watch not for the show, but everything I do now is for the show. So to refresh myself, I rewatched first couple episodes of Moonbase 8. It's a show on Showtime. Came out last fall, created by and starring Fred Armisen and Tim Heidecker and John C. Reilly of this week's movie, as well as the director is also one of the creators, Jonathan Kreisel, who helped create Basket. So it's just an all-star thing. And it's so good. If you haven't seen Moonbase 8, it's a great lighthearted comedy, really delightful performances from all these guys. And it's just very much this character comedy because they're all these flawed idiots, but they're all also really lovable. So the fact that you're like bottled up with them in this simulated moon base, and a lot of the episodes almost have no other characters appear. So you're just with these three guys, and yet it's just so fun to watch them bounce off each other. It's a really good show.
Yeah, I feel like this show flew under the radar. I didn't really hear about it when it came out. It was only recently I became aware of its existence, and I have not got around to watching it yet. But with a review like that, I definitely will check it out. It's got lots of people involved that I like.
Yeah. I feel like that's what's happened with most Showtime shows, where you hear about it when it comes out, and then I don't know if they just significantly cut the budget for advertising after a show is released, but that's pretty much, I mean, it was a good series, incredibly dry, and they did it very well.
They don't have much of a marketing budget, but they also manage to have all their shows go for 7 or 8 seasons somehow. I don't understand it. They just have bottomless pockets, apparently. I did check out The Tomorrow War, which we almost did a bonus episode on, but Ian talked me out of it. And have you guys seen The Tomorrow War yet?
I did, yeah.
What'd you think of it, Andrew?
I mean, I feel like the way everyone thought of it, I was not impressed.
I actually really liked like the first half of it. I thought the setup was cool. The explanation for time travel, like the two rafts moving along a river, was one of the more like...
I thought that was a creative... I like Sam Richardson in it. Sam Richardson is, of course, always great.
Mike Mitchell. They had some really funny people. Mary Lynn Roskob. Like, they had some...
In a very weird role for her. I mean, she's done 24. We've seen her do action, but this was strange. It was like, is that one of those things where it's like, is this that Mary Lynn Roskob? Does she know somebody? Is she doing somebody a favor?
They cast these very funny people and just straight action roles. Yeah. It was a bizarre choice, but it worked for me. It made it almost more believable. Like, you have these oddballs that get sucked into the military with no warning. So it makes sense that they would not all be like hardened soldiers, and some of them would be quirky weirdos. But I thought the last third of the movie was just bonkers in a bad way and fell apart completely. So that's kind of why I wanted to do a bonus episode on it, because it's fun to talk about bad movies sometimes.
No, there were really just two big parts where they lost me. One, with the idea of, we're just going to send you all in the future for a week and just see what happens, instead of like, you know, we have 30 years we could spend training you. Right. Maybe we should do that. And then the other part where it's like this just massive buildup of, he's a family man, and then he leaves his family for some reason, but we don't really explain it. And also, how do the timelines work if in this timeline he doesn't? And it was just very much like, you set very weird time travel rules to just kind of change all of this.
Right. And he was like a very bland character for Chris Pratt to play, this guy who has these legit comedy chops and is a very funny improviser. But he's taking these roles lately that are just so like bland Christian father figures, and it doesn't work for me. But yeah, the ending is very ambiguous, because without spoiling too much, they are only drafting people that are dead in the time period they're sending them to already, to avoid paradoxes. But he seems to make a statement like he's going to change his fate, but then how does that affect the future? Hard to figure out where they ended up going with that. But we are getting The Tomorrow War too, so no need to fear.
Are we really?
Yeah, they already greenlit it. So
that feels like a bad decision.
A lot of people must have watched it.
When you only made half of a good movie and then the second half just crashed and burned horrifically, it's amazing that they think they can pull out of that dive and carry on from there.
What about this? Maybe The Tomorrow War just goes back to halfway through the first movie and then switches everything up from there. Time travel exists in this universe, so why not? We could do that. So, now that we got that out of the way, we're talking about Walk Hard: The Dewey Cox Story, a beloved bomb. And what is your relationship with this movie, Andrew? When did you first see it? What were your first impressions of it?
I mean, I saw it fairly recently, considering it came out in 2007. I only saw it a few years ago for the first time. And I mean, I was very impressed, and also get why it didn't hit as well as I think it should have. In fact, when I watched it, and then I Think You Should Leave as a comparison for everything. This was before the new season came out, and I thought this would have worked better had I Think You Should Leave already existed. Because I feel like with Walk Hard, so much of the joke was that they were telling you the joke. They were just setting up and saying, this is what it is. Because a lot of parodies are very much like, oh, this is what they normally do, and here's a more intense version of that. And this one was like, here's what they normally do, and take a look. It was like they're explaining the magic trick while they do it. Right. And I thought it was great. I thought that was a very cool, unique way to put it forward, and a risk. But I could see people being like, this is just, they're not doing anything. They're just saying it. And it's I could see why it missed for some people, but I thought it was fantastic.
Right. The movie does this very over-the-top foreshadowing throughout the entire, like, nothing terrible has ever come from any dizziness. Like,
right.
It's so obviously poking fun at the tropes of the genre, but also setting up the movie itself. So it is a very meta comedy that's also trying to tell a real story as a biopic would. So it's in a kind of weird middle ground there. And Ian, what about you? What do you remember about this movie when it first came out?
I remember not wanting to see it. And I successfully did not see it as a result of that. This came out at the time where John C. Reilly was mostly known, at least to me, as a serious actor. And I knew him from Magnolia. I knew him from Gangs of New York. And I knew him to be a very scary, mean asshole that I didn't like because he was so good as an actor playing those roles. And so I was like, oh, I don't like this guy. And he looks kind of harsh in the commercials. And somehow I just avoided it. And then I've since heard that it's adored by many friends, you guys included. And I'm like, okay, let me go see what this is about. So we'll get into the reaction part of it, but I think I probably feel pretty similar to Andrew and feeling when I finally got around to it, there was a lot of expectation and it's fairly mild on the comedy, especially in the first third of the movie. So I also get why it didn't quite work for big audiences.
Yeah, I actually went and saw this in the theater when it first came out and I've watched the trailer a few times to prepare for the podcast. And I wonder why I went to see this because I didn't like the trailers, but the movie itself, I adore. I really enjoyed it. It was very tough to market. One of the things that I learned while researching the movie is that the whole promotional circuit was done during the writer's strike. So they couldn't go on late night TV shows and explain the premise of the movie in that more intimate setting where you can get more of the background. And so if you're just going off the trailers, you don't really know what tone the movie is going to hit. So to try to get the word out about this movie, they actually sent John C. Reilly on tour and he toured as Dewey Cox for about a month before the movie was released instead of doing the usual promotional stuff you would do that they weren't able to do because of the writer's strike, which I thought was an interesting choice, but I don't know how effective that would be. Like, how many people can he honestly play for at these shows? Is it really going to change the fate of the movie?
When the movie hasn't come out, so they don't know why to go see him. Although at this point, of course, Chicago had already come out and I loved him in that. So we'd at least heard him sing before we knew he could do it. But that's still a weird strategy when people don't know who this character is.
Right. And no one's going to know any of the songs. And it's always weird to see somebody play music when you don't know any of their songs. No one sings along. You just sit there and nod.
Especially when the songs are satire.
Right. And some of these, and like, we'll dive into how much of these songs really are satire and how much of them are played totally straight.
But they were fantastic though. The music was so good.
It's really good.
For one thing, John C. Reilly has a great singing voice and he's an accomplished guitarist. And they brought in some real heavy hitter musicians to help round out the soundtrack. So, but it's funny you mentioned, I think you should leave because the day Robert Palin's murdered me is obviously like, owes a debt to Dewey Cox. And of course, Johnny Cash. But I love that skit. That might be my favorite skit from the whole series.
It's pretty incredible. Yeah.
So before we go over the plot of the movie, I like to go into the background of how the movie got made. So do you mind if I do my little monologue?
Please.
Yeah, let's hear how this thing happened.
All right. So in 2004, Ray was released to box office success and widespread critical acclaim. One year later, Walk the Line was another smash hit and critical darling within the musical biopic genre. At the same time these movies were flourishing, writer, director, producer Judd Apatow was having his own string of successes with irreverent, mostly R-rated comedies he had some part in creating, like Anchorman, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Talladega Nights, Knocked Up, and Superbad. Apatow had carte blanche, or a blank check if you listen to other movie podcasts, to make whatever projects he wanted to come to life.
And sometimes they bounce, baby.
He asked his longtime friend Jay Kasdan, who up to this point had directed three movies to varying levels of success, if he had an idea for a movie he wanted to make. Kasdan had enjoyed music biopics, but also recognized their tropes and tendencies were ripe for parody. The two conceived and wrote Walk Hard together, offering John C. Reilly the title role due to his ability to effectively perform both broad comedy and serious dramatic roles.
He wants to be formal, but he's here to party.
Original music was written for the movie, period accurate costumes and instruments were found or made, and John C. Reilly even toured as Dewey Cox to drum up buzz for the film. The cast and crew were thrilled with the result when the movie was finished, and critics mostly agreed, giving the film positive reviews. Audiences, however, could not be bothered, ignoring the movie upon its release as it only managed to earn $20.6 million against a $35 million budget, devastating the people involved with the project.
The wrong film died.
However, the movie would thrust itself out of this dark fucking period and find an enormous following after its home media release, becoming a true cult classic.
So there was a happy ending, despite the fact that the movie died 3 minutes after it was released.
Yeah. I mean, when this movie came out on Blu-ray, there was not a single person that came over to my apartment and was not subjected to it for two hours. Yeah. I showed it to just about everybody I could.
And most parodies, when they're covering something this broad, are just going to go very crass or very dirty or very obvious. And I mean, not that there aren't good parodies, but for the most part, parodies are pretty unimpressive. They just rely on taking the thing and poking at it with a stick. And that's how a lot of these parodies are successful. And this one just didn't do that. I mean, it was amazing the stuff that they pushed off here and how much they're just throwing it at your face. I mean, it was great, but it was also one of those ones where, again, same thing as like, you should leave, where every comedian you talk to will tell you how much they love it. And most non-comedians, when you talk about, I think you should leave, don't understand what the hell you're talking about or why you're making them watch this over and over again.
Also, the state of movie parodies was in a real sad space when this movie came out. We were getting those epic movies, date movies, those really low effort parodies that are literally just like, remember that scene? Here it is with like a different actor who looks like that person. Whereas Walk Hard was referencing specific scenes from movies, but it wasn't just saying, look at this thing you remember. It was also trying to poke fun at why that scene was in the original movie to begin with and trying to get to the root of not only what makes musical biopics and biopics in general good, but also what makes them so fucking predictable.
I feel like this is a movie where you absolutely sound like a douche explaining why it's good, because it's like, no, you got to look for the nuance and you got to see what they're going for here, and you could be in the writer's room and say, Dan, I just want to watch the movie. There's a guy singing and this should be so easy, and it makes you work, and I get it, but I still thought it was fantastic.
Yeah, Ian, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, it almost works, or when you go and you look for a commentary about the movie now, it's seen almost as a work of film criticism. Like you were saying, John, it's not just a parody where you go, those dumb, scary movies. It's like, let's think about what you're doing when you're constructing a biopic and all the ridiculous constraints that puts on these movies. And I guess the difference is like the thing that they're parodying is much more serious, right? When you're parodying slasher films or disaster movies of the 70s and 80s, like the Zucker Brothers were doing, you already had something that was somewhat ridiculous or broad in its form. It was thin material to begin with, and you could go anywhere from there. And these guys, I think, were expressing both their serious commentary on the big flaws in the genre and the mistakes and the cliches that seem to be piling up as like Ray and Walk the Line just kept reinforcing these crazy cliches. But they also had a great love for it, right? Like you look back and you hear what these guys had to say about it. Like they also love those films and they love the ones that they grew up on. If you look at the age of the filmmakers of Kasdan and Judd Apatow, as we call him on the pod.
Our transcription software thinks Judd Apatow's name is Jet Apatow. So now we just call him that.
That's a good guess.
But these guys, like, he's old enough to have grown up with seeing Coal Miner's Daughter when it came out, seeing the John Carpenter, Kurt Russell, Elvis movie come on TV in 1978. He's just old enough to like be aware of those things. And then all the way up through La Bamba and Great Balls of Fire, which they talk about are influences on this. So you could definitely see them expressing both the love and the parody side of this genre.
Yeah, and maybe that lends itself to why the movie has less of just a madcap zany pacing. It really is paced like a true biopic with jokes sprinkled throughout, but it's not just moving from joke to joke one after another.
I mean, you guys have a movie podcast, so I'm sure you've had this experience. When someone tells you about a movie that's so good and you ask about it and they say, yeah, it was just this devastating, heart-wrenching 2 hours where you see just a guy starving in the woods and you're like, this sounds terrible. I don't want to experience any of this. And you're like, that's so good. And it's like, technically, I'm sure it was good, but I don't want any of those feelings. Am I going to enjoy watching it? And absolutely not. A lot of movies are not made for you to enjoy watching them. They're made for you to appreciate them, and I don't want to do that. That sounds like so much effort. And I think that was interesting because this was one too where you could enjoy it, but it also had the appreciation side. And I get it, because I hate people who have told me to appreciate movies, and I do it to friends with comedy all the time. It's like, no, you're looking at this not to laugh but to understand. It's like, it's comedy. I should be looking at it to laugh. I know how terrible I sound telling you about this. Nobody wants to do it for these reasons. But they had so much depth and history. There was a lot to cover in there, that it was one of those that, like, yeah, I laughed a lot, but also I get that it was an appreciation film, and I can't in good conscience recommend someone go watch a film they have to appreciate instead of enjoy.
It's a hard line to walk, no pun intended, to be a parody and an homage simultaneously, which is what I think this movie really is.
I feel like that was intended. I feel like
that. I had that one in the chamber, I'm not gonna lie. All right, but I am the guy who tells people to appreciate movies. My sure. wife is always like, I'm not watching a movie you pick anymore, because go make her watch Whiplash, which is just last 2 hours of J.K. Simmons just beating the shit out of college kids. She's like, I don't want to watch movies with you ever again. So
it's amazing the things I'll watch J.K. Simmons do, though. And it's like, right? Oh, okay. I mean, this should be terrible, but I fucking love it. That's J.K. Simmons. Just whatever you want to do, just put a camera out there. I'll watch it.
Exactly. All right. Usually we run through the story of the movie to catch fans up who haven't seen it in a long time or ever. But do you want to start running us through the plot of the film?
Sure. So as a boy, Dewey Cox, played by John C. Reilly, accidentally chops his brother in half in a tragic machete incident.
Fantastic delivery for that line. Such gravitas. Take it that serious.
He never forgives himself, and neither does his father. As a young teen, he discovers his talent for rock and roll music, but when his family and his community don't approve, Dewey leaves home with his school sweetheart, Edith, played by Kristen Wiig, to pursue a career in music. When a record exec gives Dewey his lucky shot in the studio, he pulls out an original song, Walk Hard, which becomes a literal instant hit and makes him a rock star.
Literally becomes number one song in the country while they're recording it, for sure, which is just a fantastic bit.
And a great scene with John Michael Higgins, too, who I love every time he comes up.
Yes.
Also, just a thing, I don't know if you guys want to include this in the podcast, but I think it would be great if you just had 96 minutes of dead air here for all of the people to go and watch this movie really quick and then come back and see if they can appreciate it.
We're going to pause and...
guys, this would be great. We're just going to all hold for 96 minutes and let you
and
check
it's
it
just
out.
Breathing on the microphones. For
yeah. We're going to see the podcast 4 hours and 47 minutes. What the fuck happened?
We'll watch it in the background and occasionally you'll just go, yeah, that was good.
I do enjoy all the throwaway lines they do in this section of like, ain't nothing horrible going to happen today with Dewey and his young brother, Nate. But it points out one of the issues with these movies that is, if you're including something in a biopic, it's obviously going to be like a monumental moment in that person's life. Otherwise, you wouldn't include it. So it makes it really hard to surprise the audience. Any scene that happens, especially a childhood scene, is going to have some kind of formative event in it, which in this case is Dewey chopping Nate in half with a machete. He cut him in half real bad.
And I think the lead in of all the almost accidents were because, like, right. You know he's going to die. So they're setting it up. Let's do all these crazy dangerous things.
Yeah.
And then leads to machete fight, and even then they managed to somehow set the machete fight like this is somehow going to be safe because they've got the sheaths on. I mean, it was just a good back and forth, and yeah, they're just constantly setting you up. And as you said in the intro, that it's dark fucking period where they're just going to keep hitting it over the head, which I just loved.
I think they were welding at one point. Was that?
Oh yeah. There was a big spray of sparks hit going out onto the floor of
the dry hay. And also, did you know Nate welds him a giraffe, and then Dewey gets a giraffe as a musician, which I thought was a nice parallel.
Yeah,
I didn't notice that the first time I saw this movie, but or the second or third or fourth or fifth or sixth, but I noticed it this time. So age brings wisdom. The smell blind jokes.
Oh,
we have to talk about the smell blind storyline. This is one of the few repeated jokes in this movie that doesn't work for me as well. What did you guys think of it?
I mean, obviously they're just trying to add a Ray parallel here, except obviously make it pointless. I don't think it landed quite as well as it could have, but I did like the intent with it of the idea that this has absolutely nothing to do with anything he's going to do. It does not affect his music. Honestly, I think the reason it didn't work was that it was one of the few they pulled back on instead of hitting it really hard, because they had a line later where his mom says, I can't believe you did this without your sense of smell. He says, it's okay, I learned to play by ear. And it was good. And I felt like they kept hitting that, it would have worked really well. But each time they put it in, I think they just pulled back on it.
That's the one line I actually pulled aside. I was like, this is the only time I liked the smell blind storyline, is when his mom comes up to him before the talent show.
Yeah.
Oh, mama, I learned how to play by ear. It's okay.
Yet for me, that joke, even the cutting in half joke, and then the big joke of the talent show is that he debuts the mildest, sweetest, most innocent song you can imagine, and it drives all the girls crazy, and it drives all the townsfolk into wanting to burn him at the stake. And those are all okay, but they're all pretty mild jokes, and each one of them takes several minutes to sort of set up and deliver, and you see it coming, and they spend a lot of time with it. So to me, I think to your point, Andrew, like, for me, the best parts of the movie is when they go bigger, like when they went more Zucker Brothers in the parody and introduced something really, I mean, I guess chopping your brother in half and having him sit there and talk to you that's pretty absurd. But for some reason, I don't know, I was just turned off by the gross out nature of that joke. And so then the rest of it is like these mild jokes that are sort of stretched out. And I don't know. I felt like if I would have watched the second half of the movie first, it would have taken me in better because there was more zany stuff in the second half.
I think the talent show worked for me, specifically having John C. Reilly play a 14-year-old world and have his bandmates act the actual like 13 and 14 year olds, like the physical visual
with
comedy
no effort
there
to make him look younger. I love that too, where it's all he's clean shaven, and John C. Reilly is so good that he actually does add that innocence to his voice, but he doesn't make it, he doesn't make it higher or anything. He keeps
it's
it
like the inflection. Yeah. He gives it like a different inflection.
He's just very clearly this adult man who is just there. And yeah, I think it was a great addition to have him there with all the kid bandmates. And I actually did like the scene where everyone freaks out, because I thought that was, again, hitting a trope and hitting it well, just because it, not just a trope in movies, but in reality, this was a thing, and how often it happened in history where it was just something mildly new and nobody knows what to do. So it has this extreme reaction.
Right. If you listen to the Beatles' early songs, they're just so milquetoast. And
I mean, this was I Want to Hold Your Hand parody on this. And again, a really catchy though. I mean, I was really amazed at how much of the music was stuff like, oh, I would actually listen to this. For the cutting in half, I that was again one where it was dumber, so I didn't like it as much. I was glad that they didn't make it really gross, because I very rarely see a parody where it's not just making it gross. He was just cut in half, and you just showed a top half and a bottom half.
It was dumb, yeah.
And just with the idea of in biopics, you know the character is going to die. So when they have that dramatic just hold on speech, it's like, oh, well, no, is there a chance? Obviously not for us. And this one, it was like, he's cut in half, so everyone knows there's no chance. And they're still giving that speech of like, you could make it. You could be a successful half person.
And the doctor with his, we were unable to attach the bottom half of his body to the top half of his body. And the parents screaming at him to speak English because they're not scientists. Was a good moment. But a musical moment that was intentionally bad was Dewey recording That's Amore, which I found hilarious. I really enjoyed his rendition of That's Amore.
That country twang that he hits so bad. I mean, he really sang in a number of styles very convincingly throughout the whole film. Because obviously he's parodying so many that, I mean, obviously he hits Bob Dylan at one point very hard. He does this country style. He does Johnny Cash. He does Beatles. Just the range of stuff that he sings in these completely different voices was very cool.
Yeah, he's a bit of a vocal chameleon. He's able to mold his voice to fit whatever genre he's in.
I mean, as an actor too, he's one of my favorites in general. Just anything. My favorite anything. I think he's fantastic every time I see him. I know he was one of the only people in like the past 70 years to be in three films that were nominated for best film in the same year, right?
Oh, yes.
And the only other time this was done was in the golden age of Hollywood when you had 10 nominations a year. So the only time it's happened since then was in 2017 when they had 9 nominations that year. So he's the only one to do it when there are 5 out of the 5 films that were nominated, he was in 3 of them. And everything he does, I feel like he just adds a boost to it. He's always got a unique angle. He can play such a huge range. So I love seeing him.
Yeah, he was a recognizable actor when he was coming up in those like Boogie Nights, Magnolia. Heart 8 is a great underrated performance of his, if you guys haven't seen that. Yeah. Paul Thomas Anderson's first film, or first like widely released film. Gangs of New York, he played like a kind of cruel stupidity really well, if that makes sense. Yeah. But then when he started branching out into these other roles, I was shocked. And he's been like, he's this acclaimed actor, but he's been Steve Brule for like 11 years running now on Tim and Eric's projects. So he really is a unique guy with just a super wide range, like you were saying.
Yeah.
We want to talk about the nightclub sequence a little bit before we move on. What'd you guys think of him taking over Bobby Shadd's band? Craig Robinson, great in that role in the short time he had. Loved him there. But this is a good send up, though, of that cultural appropriation that was so common in rock and roll, like in the early days, too. And
it was, I think, because they showed what it was doing, where he said, no, I've memorized his act completely, and he does it just like him. And he takes the vocal intonations and things enough that it's clearly would be offensive to do it for real, but I was glad they didn't push it too far. They didn't make it needlessly offensive. They're just showing why this would be. Where again, I just liked they pulled back on that kind of thing and didn't make it crass for no reason. So it was cool. It was just like, yeah, this is something we've done historically. Let's make it clear exactly how much we've done it by having him do it word for word, shifting his voice. I loved it.
Right. And it harkens back to my point from earlier, is that it advances the story too. So he's not just, they're not just doing it to make the joke about, isn't it funny that he's copied this guy's whole act when he obviously shouldn't be, but also it gets him a record deal.
Right. And just having the guy stand there saying it should be me, it's like, yes, it obviously should be you. They're making it very clear what's happening.
Right.
And I thought that was great.
Little piece of trivia. Bobby Shadd was the name of Jet Appetite's grandfather, who was a record producer and actually produced the first Janis Joplin album. So they included him in the movie there for Bobby Shadd and the Badmen, which I thought was pretty neat.
That was a good name too.
That is a great like rock and roll name.
Yeah. I just wanted to jump in because I think Andrew, you're spot on with that. Was a cool scene where they made some social commentary and they did it with a deft hand where it needed a sort of a careful touch to not become offensive in itself and calling out a problematic part of music history. But then in the midst of that scene, they threw in the Orthodox Jewish characters who run the music business. And obviously there's a lot of Jewish people involved in writing and making this movie, and they can do that if they want to do that. But to me, that stuff felt like that's where they did cross the line, that I'm like, okay, this is tedious with how heavy-handed they were with that part. At the same time, they were handling this other part nicely.
Yeah, it felt a little unnecessary. This was when I paused it and looked up to see who wrote it, because I'm Jewish, so this is fairly standard. I'm okay with the send-up, but also this is one of those tropes that has been harmful, the stereotype that we run entertainment industries.
Right.
So I was a bit more okay. It was okay, no, other Jews were behind this. If they want to take a shot, not sure it's the best move, but I didn't have too much of a problem with it. I like that they had Jews playing the roles, at least. I don't know if every one of them were. I thought it was a little bit unnecessary because I don't think it hit any marks in particular that accomplished anything. So it was like, you're just putting in a stereotype here that's not helping anybody and it's not helping your story. So I was more okay with it since they were Jewish, but still, I think it was a bad choice.
And it comes up constantly throughout the movie. So it's not like a one-time joke and then it's done. It's a recurring thing.
Yeah, they don't let it go.
And that because it came up constantly, I thought, oh, okay, they're going to do something with it. Mm-hmm. And that I would have been okay with that too, a reason why it's beneficial or that it ties in specifically, some contrast here. But no, instead, they just specifically kept having more Jews come in. And they had Harold Ramis, they had Simon Helberg, they had some good people for these roles, but it was still a weird choice. Oh, and David Krumholtz, who I always love seeing pop up so randomly. So yeah, some good people, but also just a why? What is this doing for any of us?
Because those characters appear throughout the film, there were chances, like you say, to subvert expectations or to do a flip on it at some point, but they just kept hitting that note, which that would have been surprising and funny in a Mel Brooks movie where it's, oh, we haven't seen that many characters like this on the screen. This is like a fresh kind of place that he's taking us. But it felt weirdly out of place in this movie.
I agree. Mel Brooks, I think, did some of the best parodies ever, was a big idol of mine growing up. Obviously, he came in as the Moyle in Robin Hood, Men in Tights, or the rabbi with the Moyle side gig, basically. So now he's done great roles where he hits that really hard. But also then you've got a Borscht Belt comedian who has made this a part of his identity, is intrinsically tied to this. A lot of it was commentary. So it had value when he came in a heavily Jewish stereotyped role. This one, I think it just didn't really accomplish anything.
Agreed. Yeah. All right. So I'm going to take us through the next leg of the movie. So in the 1950s, Dewey's rock and roll career soars, but he faces a number of ups and downs in his personal life. His mother dies and his father blames it on his music. He finds romance and inspiration in an affair with backup singer Darlene, played by Jenna Fischer, but ends up losing both Darlene and his long-suffering wife, Edith. Dewey's well-meaning drummer Sam, played by Tim Meadows, accidentally introduces him to marijuana and later to cocaine. He gets busted buying drugs and spends time in jail and in rehab.
Cocaine. He does the cocaine.
Cocaine. You don't want no part of this shit. Probably the most enduring thing this movie has given like popular culture is that line. I still hear it a lot from people, whether they know it's from this movie or not. It feels like it's permeated the culture.
Oh, and they covered it so well. I mean, this was probably my favorite section of the movie too. Also, Margot Martindale as his mom, just because she can be such a serious actress. And then you see her come up, and of course, she's so good at comedy too. Jeez, the people in this cast were incredible. It really had one of the best casts, and often people that you get in as play a secondary character, but there's someone that can do it so well. And obviously, Tim Meadows, Craig Robinson, Chris Parnell, Ed Helms had a piece here too. But the Tim Meadows, the you don't want this. And I just loved how many they went through with Dewey Cox when they introduced marijuana. He said, I don't want a hangover. And there's no hangover. Well, I don't want to get addicted. It's non-addictive. How many did he hit? Five? I don't want to overdose. I'm going to make me want to have sex. Yeah. And it sounds kind of expensive. Each one is just hitting harder. It's the cheapest drug out there. And I love so you don't want it follow up with, I think I kind of want it.
That really does work. Yeah, Tim Meadows is great in that role. Also, Margot Martindale, I don't know if you guys have seen Justified, but she plays such a menacing character on that show. Yeah. And then to contrast it with her performance here. And also, she plays several scenes across from Raymond Barry on Justified, who plays Pa. His performance is something I think we kind of need to talk about. I did not love him in this movie.
He was not just the straight man in this. He had to be angry the whole time. And it just was one of those things where I got it. I got that he was adding a balance, but also I didn't really get to enjoy it. And I know he's capable of doing a lot here, but it was kind of important that he was consistently not funny. And also you just keep getting in the line of the wrong son died. And it was, which I mean, was also a good hit a couple times, but it wasn't one of those that I think either you need to go much smaller or much bigger and add some purpose behind it.
Right. It just made his scenes unpleasant with the way he was like right down the middle. The line of his that I really enjoyed was, "That's what your music does, Dewey. It kills people."
Oh, yeah.
That was the one line that really made me laugh.
Especially with how it was dancing, tripping, falling out a window. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's the music's fault. Which, again, it just has a very footloose feel to it, too, where it's, we're going to blame this rather than any responsibility. I thought that was a great line.
And this is where we start to see Dewey cross paths with more and more celebrities, famous musicians, and people from that time period. And the joke of him constantly referring to them by their full name to remind the audience who it is really works for me.
Even with the Beatles, where he's like, "And you're from Liverpool."
That's right. We are the four Beatles from Liverpool.
They kept pounding it. That was great. And yeah, they had big names playing these bigger musicians as well as musicians coming in and playing themselves. And it was very cool.
The Jack White is Elvis. I maintain this is the most accurate portrayal of Elvis ever.
It was good.
I have just a sneaking suspicion this is exactly what he was like. So, and Jack White looks downright diminutive next to John C. Reilly. Jack White's 6'3", and he is just towered over by Dewey Cox. So
that's interesting.
Yeah, John C. Reilly is not a small man, which is another reason it was so funny to see him play a 14-year-old. What about the addition of Darlene to the movie in this stretch?
I thought she does a great job. Obviously, Kristen Wiig is playing the first wife, who also, it was a hard one to give up because you don't want to say goodbye to Kristen Wiig. And I love that the take of where she's berating him. He says, "I think I'm doing pretty good for a 15-year-old with a wife and a baby." I love that they didn't mean this was established over a number of years and he's still in this position. This is, it all just happened and he's here. And I really liked her line where, because obviously they keep hitting the "you're never going to make it," where they're saying goodbye on the phone and she says in this really sweet tone, "I love you. You're never going to make it, okay?" And it was a perfect delivery. So I thought Jenna Fischer came in and did a great job. It was just also meant, oh, Kristen Wiig has got to go, which you get, it has to happen for this kind of story. Jenna Fischer's fantastic. This was, what, early Office, right, when this came out?
Yeah.
So she's at her height right here. And I think she does a good job.
It's interesting to see the performances that Kristen Wiig gives and then to bring in Jenna Fischer and have her play alongside Dewey as well, because they're such different performances.
Huge,
like Kristen Wiig is playing so broad and just like zany comedy. The Candy House like exchange is another one that I love. But then Jenna Fischer comes in and has to play a full character, even though she's obviously making a lot of jokes and she's doing some silly things throughout, but they have a real kind of arc to their relationship. So it references back to the movie's trying to be two things. It's trying to be a real movie about this made up musician, but it's also trying to poke fun at this genre. So her performance, I think, really drove that home for me because of what they're asking her to do. And I think she really does a great job.
I think that's a good point. I hadn't thought about it because I was trying to figure out, I really wouldn't have wanted to see the roles switch as much as I love Kristen Wiig. And I think you're right. Kristen Wiig's whole point was that she was one dimensional. She was only this one thing to him. And suddenly this is this woman that when Jenna Fischer comes in, that's challenging him and is going to be a broad character and opening up to a new world. So I thought she did a very cool job with it.
And I think at this point in the Office's run, Pam as a character was still kind of meek and soft-spoken, and she comes into her own as the series progresses and becomes more outspoken.
Right.
So it was really strange to see Jenna Fischer going for these big laugh moments in this movie, because
she takes some big swings.
Yeah, she really does.
Yeah, John, in the Ringer oral history of this movie, which you found, which is a fantastic resource for anyone who likes this movie, there's just tons of quotes from the filmmakers and the actors, and she talks about she was scared to. I think she auditioned for both parts, and she thought she was a better fit for the first wife, and she was not comfortable playing the sexy chanteuse or whatever the word is, but she kicked ass. She was hot, she was powerful, and was a great companion for John C. Reilly.
The scenes when Dewey goes to rehab are some of my favorite in the movie. The blankets back and forth with the doctor and the nurse is a exchange I treasure. I still say it lots of times if I'm ever like in a situation where I thought I would be warm, but suddenly I'm cold, like if I'm sitting outside anywhere and I'm like, more blankets.
It was good. that, especially because it's like their only response to this was blankets. Right. Like, that's it. There's no, okay, you're going through withdrawal. This is a process. It's like, no, he just needs more and less blankets at the same time.
I think the movie's mostly making fun of Ray here, because Ray has some rehab scenes that are pretty much this. Right. They don't really dive more into what his body's really going through.
And this is also what Let's Duet, right?
Yes, that comes from the section of the movie.
Okay, which, I mean, I thought was great.
Yeah, and Ian, you had an interesting point about that song, right?
It was interesting because I went through and, you know, me coming in as the skeptic of this movie for whatever reason, and I'm like, oh, this is weird. The tone is weird. Here's a comedy song. And I'm like, and then I got more and more the feeling that way. But a lot of the songs in this movie are actually straight. There's almost no jokes to be found in the lyrics.
Oh, yeah.
They're sung straight. And then I went back again on my most recent rewatch, and I'm like, Let's Duet is almost the only comedy song in the whole movie. Like, it's just jokes. It's every lyric is a joke, right?
I thought that was incredible that they only put one in there. And then when they went big on too.
Yeah. Right. It's very funny, but it sort of keeps you unsettled about, okay, what is this movie? What is it trying to do?
Right.
Yeah. A lot of the other songs are written to be real facsimiles of a song in that style from that era that you could theoretically have heard on the radio and been a hit song. And they were all really well written and recorded.
Yeah. They're like excellent tribute songs.
Once you stuck in my head afterwards, but the ridiculousness in those, like the idea that you realize Walk Hard as a statement makes no sense. He says it's a hard walk, and then he starts reversing his head, and I'm going to walk hard. And with that background, like, oh, you see how he got there. But each of the songs is much better when you have the context around it, because it's a straight song. It's sung sincerely, legitimately. It just also has this reference of some absurdity to it, which is why I thought it was so impressive, because they didn't make the songs jokes. They made them serious. They were jokes because it was referencing something in itself, and that self-referentialness was just so weird and strange and hard to pull off. And I love seeing it each time. It's a new song would come up. I'm like, this is serious again. It's just right. A regular good song.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not ashamed to admit I've had Royal Jelly and Black Sheep on my Spotify playlists for a decade now. They're legitimately good songs. But yeah, they do work better in the context of the movie. And a lot of that context is given by like montages behind the songs that kind of give some more information about what's going on in Dewey's life at that moment.
It's them pulling off their biopic parody, which is you take a good song, a well-known song, or in this case, a song that sounds like a well-known classic hit, and then you put a montage over it. And then in this case, you put a comedy montage where the ridiculous over-the-top things happen in the visuals, but the song plays it straight.
Yeah, when you see them just doing like increasingly sexual things near each other, but like the innuendo is building. The double married scene when he's finally ready to consummate his new marriage with Darlene and Edith busts in is another great comedy moment. We'd be remiss if we didn't mention it.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Very well.
When he's like, no, don't go. Okay, she's gone. So
his line too, if it's not what it looks like, he's like, it's not what it looks like to her or to me, because it has to be one of us. And that was really good. Again, just explaining it, just saying exactly what it was, and there was no answer to it. I loved it.
Yeah, that's just good writing in the screenplay.
Yeah, it was.
All right, anything else from the section you wanted to touch on, Dewey? I almost called you Dewey. Let's look at this. Got this movie on the brain.
Let's move on. There's a lot of plot in this movie.
All right.
So in the 60s, Dewey emulates the style and the career turns of both Bob Dylan and Brian Wilson. He meets the Beatles in India and they introduce him to LSD. Dewey then alienates his longtime band and they break up. He quits music and he retreats into drugs. But after another stint in rehab, the ghost of his brother convinces him he must start writing songs again.
This is a great section of the movie. Probably one of my favorite little portions. But the Bob Dylan song about little people, not great.
Yeah.
That joke is one that didn't hit for me. And the Short Panther Party being there at the rally was another joke that fell flat for me.
That was the other time when they ventured into a song that had some more overt comedy in the lyrics. Yeah, but it was kind of problematic comedy. I'm like, oh, well, I could have done without this whole scene.
Yeah, it was obviously intended to be light. And 2007, as recent as it was probably one where nobody thought twice about it. But it's obviously now when you look at like, you didn't need this. This isn't benefiting anybody. And it's taking a shot at little people kind of for no reason. So yeah, I think that was a miss. And again, it had a couple jokes in it, but that was one too where it's kind of in the middle because nothing about it was too weird. It was done seriously, but about a weird thing. So yeah, I'm not sure it quite landed.
I think what they were going for there was to show that Dewey is ignoring the people in his life that need his help, like his many, many, many children, and advocating for a group that doesn't really want or need his help, just to distract himself from what's really going on in his life. But I don't think it was demonstrated clearly enough.
I think you're right. I think that was the intent. I think now being able to look at it and understand that it had problematic connotations, or was outright problematic in some ways too, made it harder to see. Because I think at this point he was just told you need to focus on the right stuff, and like, all right, helping people, and he goes in the exact wrong direction. I think that's a great intent, but yeah, I don't think it quite went where they were trying to get it to go.
Yeah, good concept, poor execution. Yeah. But yeah, the movie's trying a lot of things, so they're not going to get everything right. The Beatles section where they go to India and hang out with the Beatles, just great banter amongst the four Beatles, yeah, which are played by Jason Schwartzman, Justin Long, Jack Black, and Paul Rudd. What a ringer's row of comedy.
Absolutely over the top in their impressions. And for some reason, Jack Black just goes Scottish at one point. Just like just making it clear, like he's lost the accent and he's not even trying to bring it back. And I thought that was cool too.
Justin Long constantly, as George Harrison, walking up to the line of "While My Guitar Gently Weeps" and getting it a little bit wrong was a good recurring joke. The Beatles really worked for me in this portion.
Yeah, I thought that was great.
The animated part was one of my favorite parts of the movie because it was just really nicely ripped off a Yellow Submarine and just, it was just goofy. And I like the silly parts of this movie.
I did mushrooms one time in my life and I had a bad trip, and I felt like this movie was a pretty accurate representation of how I felt in my own internal model.
I hope a blue meanie didn't chop you in half.
No, I wasn't chopped in half, but almost. The Brian Wilson section of the movie is probably my favorite part of this whole movie, where his mind is melting from all the acid he's taking and he's trying to make this epic song.
Right.
This song actually rules. I really love this song. If you listen to the full version of it on the soundtrack, it's a legitimately great song.
Yeah, it's a shame they didn't put more of it in the movie because it's the edit obviously focuses on the people and the story, but this is one of the songs that it doesn't do a long montage. So I didn't realize how much there was to the song. It's a legit song in that style, which is a super hard style to do. And I guess they brought in Brian Wilson's old time collaborator, Van Dyke Parks, to put this one together.
And
it's really authentic.
Yeah. Van Dyke Parks, who worked with Brian Wilson on Smile before it was abandoned. And I don't think he was involved in refinishing it all those years later, but he'd written lyrics with Wilson and done arranging for Smile. And they brought him in to help make Black Sheep happen. And the fact that they had like all those elements that you see in the studio, the Bushmen, the didgeridoos, they're all present in the song and they all kind of work, which is just a huge accomplishment in my opinion.
It is, because it was also supposed to be pointing out, I think it was a bit in the commentary on the Beatles experimental period and so many others, where they've just gone too far out there, but they also made it good. Yeah. That was very weird that it was somehow still okay.
This had some echoes of The Doors for me too, the Oliver Stone movie.
Yeah.
They went through this kind of period in their life too. Of course, Jim Morrison, his life was struck short during that period, but yeah, they had some of those same like musical excesses that were evident in this part.
And this is another part where for me, like the look of the film is so sumptuous because with the cinematography and the costumes and the sets and everything, they really went for that Oscar film look, right? Just as with the songs, they were going to go all out and recreate that. And I love that. For me, I love recording studios and stuff. So this fantasy recording studio that they built with all these musicians in it stacked up was just like super cool.
Yeah, it was the size of a warehouse. I guess that kind of speaks to like 60s and 70s excess too, though, where the musicians and the music industry just had so much money to make these dream projects happen. No longer. Not today.
Abbey Road has those incredible spaces. I'm sure there's other studios that maybe this was modeled after, but like these rock and roll artists were going into studios that were used to record symphony orchestras, right? And like Brian Wilson and just like Dewey Cox, he filled them full of choirs and didgeridoos.
An army of didgeridoos, 50,000 didgeridoos.
That was a good line too.
When the band breaks up, it's a very funny scene because they all have these very specific and very legitimate gripes with Dewey. Like he slept with Matt Besser's wife. He slept with Chris Parnell at some point during their more hedonistic days.
And was then, confused for the next 10 years.
Yeah, he had a lot of confused thoughts. But Tim Meadows with another famous line, "You never once paid for drugs, not once." And he was only supposed to say it once, and he was supposed to have a different line when they came back around to him, but he decided in the moment to repeat that line.
I think he hit it four times, didn't he?
It's at least three, maybe four.
At least three and a half. Yeah, he gets a different rhythm on the last one.
It was great.
You see the corners of his mouth like starting to curl. And one of them, because he's trying not to laugh. It's so good.
I mean, Tim Meadows is just an absolute gem. And like we said on Popstar, he is an anchor to that film and he's an anchor to this film in terms of just, you see him come on screen and you just smile because you know something good's coming.
Oh yeah. Every time I see Tim Meadows, it's always those things that where it's like, it should be bigger, but whatever role you put him in, it's weird because you focus on him, but he doesn't steal the scene because he's so good at boosting for whoever he's there with. Yeah. Son of Zorn, he was so good in that too. Like he's playing next to a cartoon character and he's still somehow doing the same thing. It was great.
Yeah. He manages to be a great straight straight man who's also just hilariously funny, which is such a hard part.
It really is.
Line to walk the line. Oh, again,
no God, just got that movie. I would love it if this was like this big moment for someone in your audience. It's like, oh my God, that's where it came from.
Wow. That. Just like the Dewey staring off into the distance moment where he's coming up with a song in his head. And then Jonah Hill popping up as older Nate. I like that Nate ages with Dewey, even though he's been dead since he was a child. Jonah Hill playing this pretty broad, pretty over the top, but it worked for me. Yeah. What did you guys think of the scene in rehab when he sees Nate's ghost?
I liked it just for the idea that this is supposed to be a Mufasa kind of moment, but instead of being given reprieve from any of these demons, it's just more of a what the fuck are you doing kind of conversation. It was like, yeah, you're messing up bad, man. Go do it right. And I like that there was that twist to it, that they didn't hit it normally. It went the exact opposite way.
One of my favorite line deliveries is, oh, he can't smell? Got no sense of smell? I got no sense of having fucking legs.
That was great.
It's classic Jonah Hill shit-talking delivery.
And the snarky,
Yeah, it's so good to have him in here.
Do you want to move on to the next section, or is there anything else from this portion you wanted to check on?
Let's hear how this thing wraps up.
All right. In the 70s, Dewey hosts a cheesy TV variety show. He finally confronts his father over their lifelong rift, and it turns into a machete duel. Dewey's dad accidentally cuts himself in half, but before dying, he realizes the error of his ways and makes peace with Dewey. Following his dad's dying advice, Dewey reconnects with his numerous neglected children, settles back down with Darlene, and finds happiness in being a family man. Finally, in the present day, a rap song has sampled Walk Hard and reintroduced him to a new generation. The music industry wants to give Dewey a Lifetime Achievement Award, so he reunites with his old bandmates and writes his final masterpiece. He successfully resists the temptations of the music world and delivers a stirring performance summing up his entire life. That's how Walk Hard ends.
Yeah, how hard could that be?
Right? Just write one piece of music.
I thought it was good. I like how they wrapped that up. I like, too, that they did set this impossible goal of he's been saying for 20 years now, no, I just need to write the one piece that sums up everything. And then they actually have him do it. And of course, they do a pretty good job because they can actually write songs really well.
It's a really good song. It's my favorite song, I think, in the movie.
It was great. I actually, despite not liking most of the stuff with Pa, I did like this ending because I just like the absurdity of him absolutely coming to peace with the idea of, oh, I just didn't realize how easy it was.
Yeah, to cut yourself in half.
I thought you really had to try, and I just did it myself. So that's it. I like that there was obviously, there should be no resolution there, but it was all that he needed. And it was like, yep, completely solved. And I like the idea that they handed this to you for no reason at all. That I really enjoyed.
Yeah, those are some of the stronger Pa moments in the film. And I love all the like nonchalant line readings as somebody is cut in half. They happen with young Nate, and they happen again here. He's like, oh man.
Like, it's just something that happens when you get older. You're going to get cut in half too. Don't worry about it. Something's going to do it.
It's like spraining your ankle. It's just, oh no. And then the award show itself has some pretty solid jokes. Eddie Vedder's speech, what you can hear of it, because he goes on for so long, but the little sections you can hear are amazing. All the nicknames for Dewey that he has. Oh, God.
That's a great bit. That worked on me for sure. And he played it just pitch perfect.
It's really messing with Eddie Vedder's image as like this really self-serious, unknowable genius that he presents himself as in the rock and roll world. And to do this goofy thing was, it really made me like him more, honestly.
Yeah, totally. Yeah,
I thought the cover that they sang, the brief that we got with the jewel of Walk Hard, was good. I wanted to hear the full version of that.
I don't know if that version's on the soundtrack,
I didn't see it, no, but I'm hoping hopefully it's out there somewhere.
More Ghostface Killah in every movie would just be a welcome thing. I can never have enough Ghostface Killah. He did a 30 Rock appearance right around this time, too, where he was...
Oh, he did, didn't
for,
he?
For the Jack Donaghy champagne that was terrible. So he was really like getting his comedy chops in during this period.
Good for him.
He delivered. Boners last for more than 4 hours. Call more ladies. I'm sorry, that's just a great line. When Dewey finally turns down a drug from Tim Meadows.
Right, and the one he turns down is Viagra. And and I like that too, that like this one, it would actually be fine.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, this one's not going to lead to any attacking donut shops or whatever he was doing when he was on speed.
That was really cute. I like that touch that the groupies were age appropriate. They had sort of aged up with the guys. And I love just that they gave Tim Meadows actually cracks a joke, right? Like he's delivering all these stupid straight lines for the whole movie. And in the end, he sort of winks at the camera and makes a joke. And it's charming.
He delivers it with such glee.
He does. Well, and especially as you mentioned, the aging up, I like that when they had the two groupies come up to Dewey at the end who were much younger, and they even acknowledge that by saying, my grandmother slept with him, where it is absolutely showing how creepy this concept is that somehow he would still be sought after by young girls at 80.
Yeah, no, everything in this last section was pretty earnest. There was some good jokes, but it wraps up like a real biopic prestige movie would, because that's how they've treated it up to this point. So they really need to hit that final note for the movie to work. And I think it's impressive that they did.
Yeah. And I think hit even harder by the fact that there was no possible what happens next by saying just immediately died.
Yes, he's 3 minutes
dead.
After.
So we told you all of it because he's dead right now.
Actually, I think the trailer shows him dying, which wasn't in the movie. It shows him like collapsing on stage.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, they cut it out. That might have been a little too dark.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it needed it either. I think the idea of just the tagline there, I think I liked it so much because it really did just show the idea of like, that's it, guys. We told you everything. And again, just showing this is how biopics are so often angled.
Can we talk about Dewey's hair? We talked about the production values in this. I felt like the thing that really sold me on him in this last scene is that damn hair. Like the wig work is so good in this movie.
I mean, the makeup was great too. I mean, obviously, well, it's supposed to be, but they've aged him and Jenna Fischer so much. And I thought they did a pretty good job with it. Obviously, it's a comedy, so it's not supposed to be perfect. But for what it was, I thought they hit it well. And yeah, the hair was great watching that change throughout the years.
As we saw, like with the cinematography and the production design, like they spent money on this, because in that last scene, the last section of the movie where Dewey goes from somewhere between 50 and into his 70s, there's not that many scenes, but there's a bunch of extra B-roll that rolls during the song of him in different locations. And they didn't reuse the same hairstyle. They kept reinventing versions of his hair, aging in different ways. Like they were super creative and they went deep on it for stuff that gets 2 seconds of screen time.
Yeah.
Right. And they don't play it for laughs. Like any makeup effects or aging effects are played pretty straight. They want this to look realistic. And I think $35 million seems low for how this movie looks. And especially considering how many periods they have to cover and they have to get new outfits and new instruments even. They were very careful to make sure if an instrument is in a musician's hand, like it was on the market to be played at that point in history. That's not cheap. Once you make something a period piece, the budget shoots up by millions because you have to find cars and there's so much you have to do. So $35 million almost seems low for how good this movie looks and how much they nailed the different time periods.
Totally.
Yeah, no, I think they did a fantastic job with it.
So that kind of wraps up our discussion of the movie. We like to look at what happened to the people involved afterwards and maybe try to come up with a reason why it didn't connect with audiences. So after the release of this movie, the cast and crew were just really depressed about the failure of the film. It was hard to read some of these quotes. I got most of them from the Ringer oral history, like we said. But yeah, this really seemed to devastate them when the movie didn't find an audience upon theatrical release.
Yeah, I was crying reading that oral history. Like these guys, everybody had a story about how they were wrecked and how their children saw them crying and it made an indelible impression on their lives. Like it was a really rough moment.
I mean, there are a lot of movies that are terrible and bomb, and I'm sure it's awful to be a part of, but I feel like it would be so much more frustrating with this where you have actually made something good. Like if people could just gave it a chance, they could hopefully get it and see this is something fantastic out there. So it's got to be harder when you feel like you've actually done it right and it's just not being in it shot.
Right. I hate to bring up Popstar again, but like in the same way, they both made albums for these movies, like full albums.
Oh, yeah. Incredible.
And it wasn't enough to make the movie a success in its time, which is just such a bummer because you know they put the effort in and what they made was good. Like it was worthy of success and it doesn't always happen. But Kasdan said, we knew we had this incredible thing. I was like, holy shit, can you believe we were allowed to do this? And then at the same time, those people at the studio who really loved it and who I'm still in contact with, I still work with some of them. I started to get the sense from them in the couple of weeks before it came out that it was going to be really challenging just to open it. They were having a hard time figuring out how to get people to get what it was and get excited about it. That's got to be so anxiety inducing for a director to just feel that creeping sense of dread as this passion project of yours is getting close to release and just knowing.
Especially when you did your job and it's like the marketing that's failing you. That's got to be just the worst.
Yeah. I mean, Ian, did you check out any of the marketing materials for the movie?
I did. You mean posters and trailers and all that stuff?
Yeah, like the basic stuff.
I remember I wasn't a big Doors fan. And so like the Doors poster that they recreated, that iconic Jim Morrison shot, somehow that turned me off too, just because I didn't like the original, and I didn't like John C. Reilly as the copy of it. I might be weird, but I don't know if that was really an engaging piece of marketing content.
The Doors is kind of a weird touchstone to focus on for the marketing of the movie, because it doesn't have a ton to do with this movie. It's just another movie.
Should have been Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
I mean, we know where you got the name from. Just lean into it.
Walk the Line and Johnny Cash are definitely the most referenced people in this movie with the joke. So yeah, the Jim Morrison thing, I don't think really worked. And the trailers were okay, but it's tough to like get across what this movie's trying to do in a trailer, because so much of the jokes arise because of the context that they're in. So there's not a lot of zany one-liners to throw in that make sense in a 2-minute trailer.
Oh, absolutely.
So how do you convey that this movie's fun and good? And I don't know.
Yeah.
It just doesn't have those trailer moments in it, which I think makes it a strong movie, but a hard one to advertise for.
Yeah. Especially when now you have a writer's strike and you can't even go talk about it.
Yeah. You really benefit from those in-depth conversations you have on those late night shows where you can really explain the movie to people who otherwise would have no idea.
Yeah, I would totally believe that's the difference between this movie. Maybe it would have never become a super smash, but if you would have been able to go on and get people on board with what you had made, there's no reason it couldn't have earned its budget back and broke even and made a little money and everyone been happy.
Well, it's not like there were no movies making money in 2007, because there were quite a few movies did well and made some real money at the box office. And sometimes we like to examine movies that did better than the movie we're discussing and see if they deserved to out-earn Walk Hard. So Ian, what's a movie you brought today?
Well, you could go into this going, well, you know what? People were really tired of parodies. This wasn't a great era for that. But this little movie called Epic Movie came out the same year. It got a 2% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, made $87 million. So Walk Hard had the right idea, combining Johnny Cash, Ray Charles, Jerry Lee Lewis. Apparently they just forgot to add Harry Potter, Willy Wonka, and Captain Jack Sparrow.
More than four times what Walk Hard earned for Epic Movie. That's a travesty. Yeah.
And I don't think I ever even was able to finish Epic Movie. I think I got a little, because it's, as you mentioned in the beginning of this, where they just said, this is the thing they did. We're going to do this.
Right.
Same thing, but dumb. And that was it. That's all Epic Movie was. And this had so much creativity behind it that, yeah, that was a shame.
Andrew, what's a movie from 2007 you thought of maybe earned a little more than Walk Hard, but that didn't necessarily deserve to?
I found it. I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry was out during that year, where just incredibly problematic and dumb and doesn't accomplish anything. I mean, I don't get the point of that at all. Even at the time, people should have been able to see the issue with it. One that I think from the same year that did at least do well and deserve it, though, not a parody, but a send up at least, was Hot Fuzz.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought they did a great job of taking, obviously, at this point, you've got the cop story, and they did a very cool job with it. And that made some money, although his movies never quite get the recognition I think they should, but it's also a unique style, and I get it not being for everybody. But again, it showed that it was possible to do a parody or a send up or something and get it going. And I think this one did it better than all of them. So I feel like the issue is somewhere on the other side.
Yeah, he never really had a huge hit until Baby Driver. We already covered Scott Pilgrim on the pod because that lost a bunch of money. But Hot Fuzz made some money. Like you said, it just wasn't a massive hit. But that's a very smart, very good example of, I think, the kind of parody Walk Hard was going for, where it's not just referential. It's more looking for tendencies that work, but are also so recognizable that they're ripe for parody.
Absolutely.
B-Movie also came out in 2007, which is just a aggressively horny movie about a bee and a human woman. I don't know why this movie had to be this horny. If you listen to the pod, you know my stance on anthropomorphic animals, and I'm not going to sit here and say that the Jerry Seinfeld bee wasn't like a little sexy, but this was a G-rated movie. I don't know why he had to be that sexy. It just seems uncalled for. And that movie made $293 million.
Oh my Lord.
Which, if you're counting, Walk Hard made $20 million.
Yeah. I mean, I never quite know how to review a kids movie, because like obviously it wasn't for me. That being said, I still enjoyed it, but I do absolutely agree about just like, God, that, why, even if you make them horny, why the sexual tension? This doesn't need to be a two-way street. And it was like palpable. And at this point, they're adding dreams and fantasies. And it was one of those things too, where it's not like, oh, this is one just the parents will get, because it was just straight up horny. Yeah. It was like, this is a bee and he wants to fuck. And that could have been the poster.
I'm on the record. I don't think B-Movie is a kids movie at all. It might have been marketed to kids, but when you get into the meat of it, it's that movie is for adults that I don't know that I want to meet.
This is people people that are going to be furries. This is like their intro. This is ground floor. This is where you find out that this might be a thing for you. Yeah. It's like, oh, okay. Well, I guess if I like the bee, there's something even better out there for me.
It's the Dean from Community. I hope this doesn't awaken anything in me.
Right. Yeah.
Ian, was there another one you wanted to touch on?
Well, it's weird because I think a lot of people probably heard Walk Hard and they were like, okay, thanks. That sounds cool. But you know what? I'd rather Die Hard. Because this was the year that the fourth Die Hard movie came out, Live Free or Die Hard, and it made $388 million, the fourth Die Hard.
That's the one where Timothy Olyphant hacks the gas lines and makes them explode, because that's a thing you can apparently do in real life.
You could say that Dewey Cox lived hard and died free, but compared to Bruce Willis, he also died broke.
Yeah. Do we have to say that, or is that just like an option for us?
I'm saying you can say that. Everything I say is optional, and it's usually ill-advised.
I did have to talk about Wild Hogs for a hot second.
Oh, God, boy.
Yeah. Wild Hogs made $253 million. It only cost about $50 million. So if you want to see a bunch of Scientologists and Republicans and millionaires cosplay as bikers, I guess that's a thing you can go do.
I mean, I get why that one made money, because it's just like the worst white guy. It's his wet dream. It's
right.
Just this fantasy of I bought a bike and now I'm a tough guy.
Oh,
instantly.
Yeah.
That's all it takes. And so I get it. You made money because you just threw it at the audience and they were going to take it. But yeah.
Just feeding the lowest common denominator with this garbage. But
like, again, it's not like I think everything needs to be art. I'm okay with some dumb stuff, but there's a level of pandering where it's like, why not just put on the poster? If you give us your money, we're going to make you feel like you're an okay person despite being like this. That's all it needs.
Luckily, though, John Travolta made another movie called Old Dogs, which failed so terribly they canceled Wild Hogs 2. So thank you, John Travolta and the team behind Old Dogs.
That's great.
For saving us from that one. All right. So I'd just like to touch on where everyone went after this movie, if it affected anyone's career. Everyone seems to have come out of this one okay, though. I think the Judd Apatow or the Jed Apatite machine was still running, and so everyone was relatively unscathed. Kasdan would direct two Cameron Diaz hit comedies that got bad to mediocre reviews. Somehow I saw both these in theaters. Bad Teacher and Sex Tape, neither of which are particularly memorable. Bad Teacher's okay, though. He would also direct the Jumanji movies, the new ones. He's behind those with the Dwayne Johnson, and those are massive hits. So he's doing well, making money, making movies with The Rock. Reilly was super prolific following the film's release. He was in 31 movies between 2008 and 2018.
Incredible. I love that about him. He's he's just working.
Yeah. He does not take days off, but he hasn't acted in a movie since 2018. So he's taken a little break now, it seems. He has been Steve Brule in multiple shows since 2010. And as Ian mentioned at the top of the show, was a star and creator of Moonbase 8 on Showtime.
And he's playing the same character in multiple shows?
Yeah, Dr. Steve Brule is like a real oddball. I don't think he's really a doctor. It's a very hard character to describe, but he's part of the Tim and Eric Awesome Show.
Oh,
great
God.
Job.
Yeah, that was okay.
He debuted on that, and then he had his own show for a while, and I think he just pops up in whatever they
that
do.
That one. Okay. God, I was seeing that. I was just trying to picture him in this doctor role. It's like, and also, how do you do this across multiple shows? But then, Tim and Eric. Yeah
obviously. Anything they have, Steve Brule's along for the ride. Moonbase 8, as far as I could tell, has not been officially canceled or renewed. I can't find anything on it. So hopefully it comes back.
I really hope it comes back.
I thought it was gone. And then I realized when we started this podcast and you said it was on Showtime that I just stopped getting Showtime.
There you go.
It's
that's
like,
one way.
Oh my God, I hate that it was canceled. It was like, no, you had a week trial, you idiot, because you watched as much as you could and then it was gone.
They canceled all my favorite Showtime shows.
Yeah, happened so fast.
And then, so Fisher, she actually starred with Reilly again and Sean William Scott in 2008 for the movie The Promotion, which was like a dark indie comedy. It's not bad, honestly, but it didn't get a theatrical release, so it's kind of hard to judge it financially and say if it was a success or not. She starred in The Office until 2013, and then she was on Splitting Up Together on ABC for two seasons. I did not watch that, but my wife Jamie did. She seemed to enjoy it. She has not appeared in an acting role since that show was canceled, but now she's like a big time podcaster. She's got a show called Office Ladies with Angela Kinsey, and that's like a huge hit. It's always at the top of the charts on podcast stuff, so good for her. She's doing something she enjoys and apparently making money at it, so what more do
there
you need?
There are like three Office podcasts with cast members from The Office, though, right?
Yeah, Brian Baumgartner's got one, Kevin. His is pretty popular. Office Ladies, and I think BJ Novak did one.
Incredible. Okay.
So, I mean, hey, that's a rich mind to
yeah,
a rich vein to mine, I guess. But and they also released an oral history of The Office. I don't know what more information you guys need about The Office. Like,
yeah,
it's all out there. Anybody wants any background information?
Like, yeah, if people want to hear about The Office, they've already heard about The Office. You don't tell somebody interested in The Office something new about The Office. It's already happened.
So that's all I had. Did you guys have any closing thoughts?
I was not told I needed an eloquent wrap-up here.
We definitely do not.
No, I mean, again, I think I said it throughout. I love the movie. I thought it was great. I wish it was given a better shot, because I think if it was put out in the right way to the right audience, it could have been a lot bigger. But yeah, I mean, I love the music, love John C. Reilly and everything. So I thought it was great.
I love John C. Reilly. And for me, you know, my litmus test is always, does a movie make me feel feelings, as well as a comedy should make me laugh? But that's where I felt this thing fell down. Like, I couldn't really connect with Dewey Cox. And I narrowed it down to thinking that maybe it's because early on, playing the 14-year-old scene, he's self-aware of the parody that he's doing. And that and some other jokes, it kind of sort of deflates his ability to play the drama real. Or if you go with him in the drama, it feels unsafe because he may become self-aware at any moment and pull that rug out from under you and play you for laughs when you were following him down a crying or otherwise serious hole. So anyway, that's my weird tortured theory on why I couldn't really connect and why the movie didn't do as much for me as it might have otherwise. But other than that, I have mad respect for everybody involved in this. It's obviously put together with a ton of heart and a ton of care by people who are just super talented. So there's tons of fun stuff to get out of it. And I would recommend it to anybody. I'm one of those people that it didn't quite hook.
Ian, I respect your opinion. That's very well thought out and eloquently put, but you're so wrong. No, I love you, Ian. And that's the kind of thoughtfulness you bring to the podcast. But I don't know, I just love this movie. It makes me smile every time. I could watch it nonstop and never get tired of it. It's a movie I'll probably stick with. I'll probably watch it like every 2 or 3 years for the rest of my life. It's just one of those touchstones for me that like changed the way I think about movies, because it achieves something so profound for me. And being a parody and an homage simultaneously is not an easy thing to do. And like you said, so much respect for everybody involved in it and balancing the tone to the degree that they did. But yeah, it bums me out that it failed, and I really feel for everyone involved because they seem to take it super hard, but I'm sure they're gratified now that it's found such a huge audience on home video and streaming.
Yeah, I'm glad it at least has that cult following now, because there are definitely those that are appreciating it.
Yeah. All right. So that was Walk Hard. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us this week.
Yeah, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you all for having me.
Please go listen to Here's Where It Went Wrong. Check out Andrew's comedy. Check out his Twitter. We'll put his @ in the show notes. We've now had your whole podcast on. We had Wensler on, and now you. So
it's a limited cast. You hit two.
We had two people.
Yeah, I'm glad you got us both on. And Wen mentioned he had a great time too. So thank you very much for having me. It was great to be here.
All right. Thank you guys so much for joining us this week. We will be back next week. Please remember to rate, review, subscribe, do what you have to do to keep Blast Zone on your podcast feed, because we appreciate you.
We do.
Shoot us a DM on Twitter, shoot us an email, blastzonepod@gmail.com. Any questions, suggestions you have, we're always happy to hear from you.
Love to hear from you.
And we'll see you next time in the Blast Zone.
See you next time in the Blast Zone.
The Blast Zone.